Hello again. We're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Bree Hayden.
Today, you have proven that Chicago cares about Palestine!
Coming up, we'll take a closer look at the protests for Gaza that are sweeping Chicago.
Where the FCC is ostensibly serving as a public watchdog, the actual policy is, like much of the FCC's history, that of a corporate lapdog.
And with the issue of net neutrality heating up, we'll hear a recent Chicago presentation on net neutrality.
A blinding flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains. Just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight.
On Saturday, July 26, 2014, an estimated 15,000 protesters rallied in downtown Chicago, demonstrating against Israel's devastating attacks on the civilians in Palestine. But that was only one of several demonstrations that have taken place in the city and surrounding communities since so-called Operation Protective Edge began on July 8, 2014. Chicago Independent Media Center reporter Rita Sand witnessed the protest in Chicago on July 20th and filed this report.
Free Palestine! Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Thousands of Palestinians and their supporters amassed just north of the Loop in Chicago on Sunday afternoon to decry Israel's attack on Palestine that has killed over 1,000 Palestinians.
And the siege of Gaza now!
And the siege of Gaza
now!
What?
Not another nickel! Not another dime!
Not another nickel! Not another dime!
No more money for Israel's crimes!
Through chants and speeches, it was clear that the group called for more than an end to the bombing of Gaza. They demanded an end to U.S. military aid to Israel, an end to Israel's blockade of Palestine, and an end to biased media coverage of the conflict. As the crowd quickly swelled beyond two city blocks, Hatim Abu Dia, a representative of the United States Palestinian Network and the Coalition for Justice in Palestine, stepped to the mic to start the program before the march. The following is an excerpt of the program.
We have called this as our fourth mass protest in Chicago in the last 2 weeks. And we are calling that this is at least 5,000 people. It's the biggest Palestinian protest in the United States. According to the Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza, today has been the bloodiest day of Israel's murderous attacks on the Palestinian people, with reports of over 50 dead, including a mass killing in Al-Shaj'iyya neighborhood. Since the beginning of the Israeli offensive on Gaza, almost 400 have been killed and more than 2,300 wounded. 400 houses have been destroyed and hundreds more extensively damaged. And since June 12th, over 1,000 Palestinians, mostly in the West Bank, but also in 1948 Palestine, have been arrested without charge. The world is saying, enough is enough. Palestinians, Arabs, Muslims, and our friends have taken to the streets in the tens of thousands across the world, in Stockholm, Tunis, Santiago, Caracas, Mexico City, The Hague, Yemen, Athens, Beijing, Dublin, Oslo, Brussels, dozens of cities in the U.S., and the largest of them all in South Africa, where over 20,000 people marched in Cape Town. In Paris, pro-Palestine rallies were banned because the Zionists attacked them and they were beaten back by the protesters. But thousands came out anyway in defiance of the ban and are still out today. Ecuador has withdrawn its ambassador to Israel. Chile has frozen free trade agreement negotiations with Israel and is also discussing the withdrawal of the ambassador. And of course, we all know, in Istanbul, activists took the Israeli embassy and then replaced the Israeli flag with the Palestinian flag. 15,000 people marched in London, and I might be aging myself a little bit here, but at a concert in the UK, Eddie Vedder, the lead singer of Pearl Jam, in the middle of the concert said, they're looking for a reason to go across borders and take over land that doesn't belong to them, and they should get out. We don't want to give them our money. We don't want to give them our taxes to drop bombs on children. The whole world is with us, the way the whole world is always with us, except for the most powerful government in the world, our own U.S. government. In fact, the same day that those four beautiful Palestinian boys from the Beckett family, Ismail, Ahed, Zakaria, and Muhammad, were killed on that beach in Gaza, our government voted to double the funding that Israel receives for a specific component of its killing machine. The deputy speaker of the Israeli parliament, who is from the ruling Likud party, said, Gaza is part of our land and will remain there forever. Subsequent to the elimination of terror from Gaza, it will be part of sovereign Israel and will be populated by Jews. This is the government we support, a criminal terrorist government that wants to rid Palestine of Palestinians. So it's time to stop talking about Israel and the Israelis as if they want peace. Palestinians are sick and tired of being asked to give Israel the benefit of some kind of doubt. Israel does not want peace. Israel only wants more and more land, and the U.S. needs Israel strong to help it control the Arab world. So essentially, Israel needs to be defeated. Israel needs to be defeated. The way it can be defeated is by organizing for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. It needs to be totally and absolutely isolated from the international community of nations. It does not belong in the international community of nations. And if there is anyone still out there who believes that Israel has the right to exist as a racist, colonialist, criminal, apartheid state, then you're on the wrong side of history. Our responsibility is to fully boycott and divest and hurt Israel economically. Palestinians have their responsibilities in Palestine, and we have a clear task here in this country. That task is BDS against Israel anywhere and everywhere, like the two great Students for Justice in Palestine victories here at Loyola and DePaul. And also, our task is to make the war profiteers and the profiteers pay. Like when five activists from the Anti-War Committee and Jewish Voice for Peace entered the Boeing building last week and didn't leave until they were arrested. And lastly, Nelson Mandela would have been 96 years old this past Friday. He spent decades in prison in South Africa as a leader of its liberation movement. And when he was released, people who had called him a terrorist for years tried to get him to criticize the Palestinians and our liberation movement. He refused and instead was quoted as saying, "Our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of the Palestinians." And just like apartheid South Africa fell, apartheid Israel will fall. Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
I want to introduce the co-MC from the American Muslims for Palestine, Awad Hamdan.
Assalamu alaikum. We could do better than that, Muslims and non-Muslims alike. Assalamu alaikum. Today, my brothers and sisters, we are here to voice our condemnation of the Israeli crimes that are being committed on our brothers and sisters. Men, women, and children who have done nothing but demand freedom are being killed every minute of every hour by this regime that cares nothing for human life. We are here to condemn their actions and to demand justice. When we started this event a week ago, we started marketing with the hopes that we'll have 5,000, but I'll be honest, the few protests before it were kind of small. But today, you have proven that Chicago cares about Palestine! Chicago! Chicago will stand for Palestine until it is free, inshallah! Our first speaker is Dr. Sinan Shakda, who is a Palestinian activist with the divestment campaign. He is also a media and social media expert who writes for multiple Arabic language newspapers in Palestine, London, England, and other countries.
Today, as we speak, the Israelis in Ash-Shuja'iyya region in Gaza are killing children. Children killed in Gaza. They killed in cold blood by the IDF. This is why I came to the street today. I came to the street to protest killing the Palestinian children. I came to the street to protest and to say as loud as I can, as clear as I can, killing children is a crime!
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 Israel is killing the Palestinian children. The White House is accountable for it. This is why we came, all of us, to the streets. This is why thousands of us around the world, across the globe, are mobilizing on the street today to protest against Israeli action on Gaza. This is why we are protesting the U.S. government. But do you think the White House will do anything about it? No! No! Because the Israeli, the pro-Israelis, they control the White House. In fact, they own it. They own the media. They own the Congress. But we own the streets! Repeat after me. We own the streets!
We own the streets!
We own the streets!
We own the streets!
Is this what we can do? Can we do more?
Yes!
Yes, we can. BDS Israel! BDS Israel! Repeat with me. BDS Israel!
BDS Israel!
BDS Israel!
BDS Israel!
Boycott Israel!
Boycott Israel!
Thank you for coming. Thanks.
Thank you, Sinan. In this city especially, and around the country, and around the world where we've seen solidarity for the Palestinians, in this city specifically, we have a special relationship with the Puerto Rican community here. The National Boricua Human Rights Network has a gang of folks right in the middle there here in solidarity with us. And the next speaker is a representative of their organization. And he's an incredibly special person because Eddie Cortez spent 18 years in a federal prison here for doing what we are doing, for fighting for independence and liberation of his country. And 40 years ago, he organized at UIC with a number of our General Union of Palestinian Students activists who are probably in the crowd here. Please help me welcome Edwin Cortez.
It's 40 years ago when I attended the University of Illinois, I became aware of the Palestinian struggle. And in 1973, I became aware of my own struggle in Puerto Rico when a teacher in one of the high schools here in Chicago said that Puerto Rico had no history, in which the government of Israel would probably say Palestine does have no history either. And we all know that we both have a rich history of struggle against colonialism. The Puerto Ricans have been fighting for 116 years against the U.S. occupation of Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is occupied by the United States government. Hear me. Do you hear me? Yeah. Palestine has been occupied by the Israeli government since 1948, and we support the right of the Palestinian people to be free. And that right, just like the right of Puerto Rico, cannot be negotiated. It is a human right. We are no negotiations for that. And Palestine has 10,000 or more prisoners, and we have Oscar Lopez Rivera, who's been locked up in a U.S. prison for the last 33 years. And we demand the immediate release of all political prisoners. And in Puerto Rico, one of the main independent newspapers is reporting the truth about Palestine that ABC, CBS does not report. Thank you, and we will see each other soon. Thank you.
Thank you, Eddie Cortez. Free, free Gaza now!
Free, free Gaza now!
End the siege on Gaza now!
Remember, we're 5,000, maybe more, 5,000 strong! And our last speaker here is another important solidarity activist and ally in the movement with the United African Organization and a dear friend of mine, Ali Kaba.
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, we are gathered here today to affirm our unconditional, unapologetic solidarity with the Palestinian people. We are here today to condemn the barbarism that has characterized the action of the military in Israel. Let us remember the history of apartheid South Africa and understand that at the time when the African Liberation Movement needed allies out there, it was the Palestinian people who stood on the side of liberation, not the Israeli government. When the Israeli government was providing military aid to the apartheid regime, providing intelligence and other logistics support, it was the Palestinian people who helped to legitimize the anti-apartheid movement on a global level. And today, we are seeing that movement of the global community, all of humanity, standing with the Palestinian people. And for those who think that it is okay to sit and accept oppression, let me say this. National resistance is the moral duty of a people under occupation. National resistance is the moral duty of the people under occupation. It is legitimate. And therefore, my friends, we have to stand with the people of Gaza, fighting on a noble cause to free Palestine and advance the cause of humanity to create a new human condition for all of us.
Palestinians, you are not alone. We stand with you. We fight together. We shall win together. This is our victory. This is our fight. Stand together. Forward. Free Palestine.
Motorcyclists sporting black and white Palestinian scarves signaled the beginning of the procession. It went from nearby the Tribune Tower onward past the studios of ABC and CBS, a route planned to try to counter the barrage of one-sided pro-Israel coverage broadcast daily by major media outlets. They had arrived by the busload to this demonstration, women in hijabs, the traditional Muslim head covering, families with youngsters and babies in strollers, young people wearing placards across their chests and backs, marking the lives lost in the last week. Dania Mehdi Hand, killed in Gaza on July 8th, read one. Haj Zayan, 16 years old, killed on July 10th. Omar Mahmoud Namawal, also killed July 10th. Many held banners or posters with graphic photos of the dead, while a group of young men strode amid the crowd supporting a coffin above their heads. Most of the sea of people were Palestinians, yet I saw several other ethnic groups participating, including at least two Orthodox Jews. Although I was not able to reach the Orthodox Jews for a comment, I was able to ask several other participants why they were there.
We need to end the violations of international law.
Why do you think it's important in Chicago to show solidarity?
It's important to show solidarity in every city in the world.
I'm here so we could free Palestine. Free, free Palestine.
Why are you here today?
To protest, because what they're doing is wrong.
Yeah, I'm with Chicago Indie Media. Can I ask you why you're here today with your children?
I'm here to recognize the children that they're killing. I have a 10-month-old and an 8-year-old. It's wrong to kill children. It's wrong. They're innocent bystanders playing on the beach. It's wrong. It's wrong for them to die. They need to wake up.
I'm here to protest for Palestine.
But why in Chicago?
Biggest city in Illinois.
We want to free the people who are being killed in both ways. If neither Palestinian or Jew, both of them are killed. The innocent people are being killed. We are here for both of them.
Why are you in this protest today?
Well, because Israel justifies what it's doing based on a lot of false assumptions, and it's just not justified to kill so many people in the name of saving people. You don't just kill innocent people. So, like my sign says, stop justifying, start justice.
I'm here in solidarity with the people of Gaza. I'm Palestinian, and what's happening right now goes against humanity. And as an American taxpayer, my tax dollars are paying for this genocide right now. And I need to come and show the world who Palestine is, and we need to end the siege on Gaza now. Definitely. I just came from there. I was in Palestine, in the West Bank, and it was a scary month because of all the raids that were coming into the West Bank for them looking for those three teens. They were coming into all the houses near my grandmother's, and it was really scary.
I'm trying to channel the energy of this crowd for a positive reaction. There's a lot of fervor up here. People want to do something, and I want them to call the White House. I've got the telephone number in my head, and I'm going to tell it to the crowd, make everybody raise their telephone and start calling the White House. We're going to shut down the White House today.
Can I ask you why you're here today?
To make our voices heard. The more people that do, maybe they'll make it an impression, for heaven's sakes. I'm happy to be here.
Hi, how are you doing?
Why did you come today?
I guess the liberation of the Palestinian people will be my liberation too. So it's all interrelated. I'm just giving my solidarity to the Palestinian people. I'm a Filipino-American by national, but I support the struggle of the Palestinian people.
We cannot sit aside and look the children and women being killed, and nobody is going to stop them. So all we can do is voice ourselves against the atrocities in Gaza.
The protesters ended their rally by raising their voices outside the Israeli embassy at 500 West Madison, just west of Union Station. They said they knew their cries would fall on deaf ears, but that maybe the media would carry their cries to ears of those who can hear across Chicago. From the trenches, I'm Rita Sand.
Net neutrality, the policy of non-interference of content and access by internet service providers, has been a struggle that has ebbed and flowed over the past decade. The struggle has reached a fever pitch in 2014, with an FCC court defeat, an FCC capitulation to big cable and big telephone companies, and a historic response by popular movements that has shaken the core of the establishment. The efforts have been chronicled in a recent presentation, Bringing Us to Tears, the 2014 Net Neutrality Lectures, by Chicago Indie Media contributor and longtime media activist Mitchell Stjepanchik. We'll hear the first two parts of the four-part presentation recorded on Sunday, June 21st, 2014.
This is a series of 4 half-hour lectures where I explain in depth one of the most popular and most important issues of our time, but one which is prone to a lot of uncertainty and confusion. And it's crucially connected to the internet, a great source of economic development, technical innovation, free speech, and political activism. To quote Federal Communications Commissioner Jessica Rosenworcel, quote, "The future of the internet is the future of everything. There is nothing in our commercial and civic lives that will be untouched by its influence or unmoved by its power," unquote. And it is the U.S. government policy over the internet that is the focus of these lectures, particularly over those policies that are most commonly known by the name network neutrality, often abbreviated as net neutrality. There are a lot of questions related to the term, which we will strive to answer over the course of these lectures. In this lecture, I would like to answer a number of key questions. Question 1, what is network neutrality? Question 2, why is it necessary and important? Question 3, what are some violations of network neutrality and have they actually occurred? Question 4, what would happen if net neutrality were abolished? So to start, what does the term network neutrality mean? A good definition is posted on the website of the man who first coined the term net neutrality, Tim Wu, a law professor at Columbia Law School in New York. Let me quote at length from a page at timwu.org, which is devoted to defining the term. Tim Wu writes, quote, "Network neutrality is best defined as a network design principle. The idea is that a maximally useful public information network aspires to treat all content, sites, and platforms equally. This allows the network to carry every form of information and support every kind of application. The principle suggests that information networks are often more valuable when they are less specialized, when they are a platform for multiple uses, present and future. Note that this doesn't suggest every network has to be neutral to be useful. Discriminatory private networks can be extremely useful for other purposes. What the principle suggests is that there is such a thing as a neutral public network, which has a particular value that depends on its neutral nature. A useful way to understand this principle is to look at other networks, like the electric grid, which are implicitly built on a neutrality theory. The general purpose and neutral nature of the electric grid is one of the things that make it extremely useful. The electric grid does not care if you plug in a toaster, an iron, or a computer. Consequently, it has survived and supported giant waves of innovation in the appliance market. The electric grid that worked for the radios of the 1930s works for the flat-screen TVs of today. For that reason, the electric grid is a model of a neutral, innovation-driving network. The theory behind the network neutrality principle, which the internet sometimes gets close to, is that a neutral network should be expected to deliver the most to a nation and the world economically by serving as an innovation platform, and socially by facilitating the widest variety of interactions between people. The internet isn't perfect, but it aspires for neutrality in its original design. Its decentralized and mostly neutral nature may account for its success as an economic engine and as a source for folk culture, unquote. Sounds great, right? A maximally useful public information network that aspires to treat all content, sites, and platforms equally. Sounds like something everyone would support, right? So if everyone would support it then, and this brings us to our second question, why is net neutrality necessary? It's necessary because net neutrality, as great as it sounds, is not universally supported. There are powerful entities that want to undo this maximally useful public information network, to change it to something over which they can gain exclusive control and exclusive profit. These powerful entities, in particular, are large-scale telephone and cable television providers, which have had a history of vertical integration with internet service providers and consolidation among themselves, where buyouts, mergers, and attrition result in fewer and fewer providers holding more and more of the market. In the phone market of the United States, we are down, at the time of recording these lectures in June 2014, to just four major providers, Verizon, AT&T, Sprint, and T-Mobile, who combined command 90% of the telephony market in the United States. In the cable market in the United States, four firms, Comcast, Time Warner Cable, Cox, and Charter, combined to command 62% of the cable television industry's revenue. And that concentration is worse when you look at it from the perspective of individual consumers. I mentioned that there are a handful of cable TV and telephone companies holding most of the market share. 20% of American households have just one internet service provider. And of the remaining 80%, more than 96% of those remaining 80% have at most two providers, a monopoly cable TV provider or a monopoly telephone provider. This concentration affects, or potentially affects, the internet and network neutrality in the following way. If an internet service provider in a more diverse market would not behave in a neutral fashion, that is, if an internet service provider would, for example, start to slow down or block outright unaffiliated content or access to content, unless folks paid more for that content, if that were to happen, then an unsatisfied consumer in a diverse market would simply switch to a different internet service provider that didn't behave so badly. But in a monopoly or in a duopoly, where parties behave like mobsters and make switching to another provider difficult or impossible, then the internet service provider has that leverage and can use it to fleece customers or degrade content or worse. Net neutrality, then, is a matter of bringing a measure of public accountability to these private shakedown artists. We, as a society, are largely unable or unwilling to take on these monopolies or duopolies. The concentrations of power and the expected consequences of markets, about which we will discuss in greater depth in a later lecture. But those private tyrannies are, in the case of the internet, nonetheless performing a public service. Historically, when that happens, when something private fulfills a public good, that falls under a practice and set of rules referred to as common carriage, with such parties being common carriers and net neutrality being an extension of that tradition of law and practice pertaining to the internet. There are and have been claims by some people, often officials who are affiliated with the Republican Party, who claim and have claimed that network neutrality is just additional bureaucratic red tape, a solution looking for a problem. For example, Federal Communications Commissioner Michael O'Reilly says that net neutrality in any form is, quote, unnecessary and defective, unquote, and doubts that, quote, there is an actual problem resulting in real harm to consumers, unquote. In actuality, there have been a number of cases of violations that can be construed as violations of neutrality on the internet, and that can illustrate specifically what could come to happen if net neutrality were to end. Before we dive into specific examples of network neutrality violations, it would be useful to note what forms such violations my take. Again, Tim Wu, the gentleman who coined the term network neutrality, offers a list of four potential violations of network neutrality, which we'll describe briefly. Violation number one, blocking. Internet service providers simply block anyone or anything they don't like. Violation number two, what's called termination monopoly pricing. Another way of saying that internet service providers can charge excessive fees to content producers or content consumers who wish to gain access to users. Violation number three, what's called playing favorites, also called most favored network violations. This is where internet service providers don't block, but instead prioritize applications and content which they like, and deprioritize that which they don't. And violation number four, transparency failures. This is when internet service providers don't say everything that they know to content providers and content to consumers, not just about the service options of what's available, but also about details of the state of the internet at any particular time. So, Commissioner O'Reilly says that net neutrality advocates fail to make the case that there's an actual problem resulting in real harm to consumers. It turns out that there are, already, on the record, instances of internet service providers who have already kicked the network neutrality hornet's nest in each of these four violation examples. Let's go through them again in turn. Violation number one, blocking. There are a number of instances in which internet service providers have been caught blocking content. In 2007, Verizon declined a request from Narrow Pro-Choice America to carry text messages. And AT&T muted some politically charged lyrics during a live stream of the musical group Pearl Jam at Lollapalooza. In both instances, AT&T and Verizon backtracked on those actions and addressed concerns voiced by Pearl Jam and Narrow. But nevertheless, blocking did happen. And that highlights the very real concern of potential abuse should net neutrality be abolished. Violation number two, termination monopoly pricing. In December 2013, Comcast began to throttle internet traffic generated by the streaming video service Netflix. Traffic improved after Netflix and Comcast in February 2014 agreed to a, quote, mutually beneficial interconnection agreement, unquote, even though, quote, terms of the agreement are not being disclosed, unquote. Indeed, there's a video segment on the HBO TV series Last Week Tonight with John Oliver where they track the throttling of traffic of that Netflix deal with Comcast and demonstrate the connection between the two. What's more, reports have since floated that a deal between Netflix and Verizon resulted in no noticeable speed improvement for Netflix customers using Verizon. Violation number three, playing favorites. In 2007, Comcast was caught deprioritizing content that used the internet protocol BitTorrent, a set of digital rules, a protocol, that's particularly useful for transferring very large files across the internet. BitTorrent is enormously popular and widely used. It accounts, by some estimates, for as much as a third of all internet traffic. BitTorrent is widely used for movie and TV show sharing, what's sometimes called content piracy. And Comcast got caught in selectively interfering with BitTorrent downloads by Comcast customers. But Comcast was not caught by the FCC or by rival companies, but by investigators aligned with outsiders, most notably the nonprofit groups Public Knowledge and the Electronic Freedom Foundation. Comcast didn't make what they did readily apparent, which also makes it an example of violation number four, transparency failures. The violation was discovered after the fact. Another example of such a transparency failure is the degrading or blocking of voice over IP calls across mobile telephone networks. Such transparency failures are often explained away as measures to address security concerns. So we see a definition of what net neutrality is. We have a description of ways it's violated, and we have concrete examples of ways in which it has been violated. So let's assume the worst-case scenario. Suppose that the provisions regarding network neutrality on the internet are abolished, and that the big internet service providers, particularly the big phone and big cable TV companies, have free rein to carry out the violations we outlined. What then? What would the end result look like? What's most likely to happen? Internet service providers in the United States would now be able to legally to block, gouge producers and consumers, play favorites, and not be transparent in revealing the details of their actions. Presumably, given the profile the issue has gotten, those Internet service providers would, as a concession, maintain a policy of neutrality, perhaps for a number of years, until the issue itself would presumably die down over time. Comcast, for example, has agreed to abide by net neutrality policies until 2018 as a concession to their buyout of NBC Universal. But after that, net neutrality, barring no other changes, will be formally ended. The policy fights will have been concluded, the policy will now be in place, the legal recourses in the courts will have been exhausted, and organized money will have defeated organized people regarding internet policy with no going back. ISPs have ended their concession to abide by net neutrality, or they will have done so, and they will begin acting in their interests. They'll begin to increase their costs for usage and for providing content. And those costs are being applied more widely. Only the wealthiest producers can maintain their access to content, while users will have their content options reduced markedly. There are graphics online that envision what this would look like, taking the form of mock advertisements. For example, in one such mock ad from the fictional company Telco ADSL, you get starting internet access at $29.95 per month, accompanied by the very legal small print known as mouse type, which says, includes 500 megabytes of free transfers to non-peering websites at full speed, limited to 120 kilobits per second thereafter. In other words, you can have access for a limited amount, and then the internet would only be available at extremely slow speeds. The ad imagines a variety of optional tiers for things like international news, domestic news, music, online gaming, online retailers, and social networks. Each of these tiers carries an additional price of $5 to $10 per month. Mind you, by current Chicago standards, even these imagined inflated prices would be lower than what we currently pay. So let's increase the cost to, say, $200 per month for basic access with tiers at $25 to $50 per tier per month. And he cites our resources by activists, nonprofits, and small-scale companies, which are not in these commercially approved bundles, would be counted against your download quota, would be available but only at exceedingly slow speeds, or perhaps blocked entirely, and if there would be no way to address these problems. If this sounds eerily like the current arrangement of cable television, it's not a coincidence. Cable TV providers also rank among the major internet service providers. Telephone providers are also getting into the act with their own clones of cable television, like Verizon's Fios and AT&T's UVerse. What's more, with their bundles of cable television channels available in these subscription platforms, what you get now with cable television eerily resembles what is envisioned with the internet later, if net neutrality is abolished. There are serious policy reasons why now we are in a now-or-never situation regarding the internet. These are tied into the history of the internet, with key implications to future policy and future crafting of how the internet works. We'll explore that history and how it ties into a key FCC vote in 2014 in our next lecture. Hello and welcome to Lecture 2, the four lecture series on net neutrality. In the first of this series of four lectures on net neutrality, we address some fundamental questions about the design principle and practice known most popularly as net neutrality, what it means, why it's important, how it could be violated, and what's apt to happen if it were to be abolished. The issue of net neutrality has gained increasing attention across the public, with points of high public interest that correlate to key points in the fight over net neutrality going back at least the last few years. But it was on May 15th, 2014, that the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, by a 3-2 commission vote, approved to proceed on a docket now formally known as Proceeding 14-28 that would mark the commission's third attempt in 7 years at formalizing net neutrality. The previous two attempts were challenged in court by internet service providers and were both defeated. The level of commentary and discussion for the net neutrality issue has now reached levels unmatched for any issue open for public comment in the history of the FCC going back to the commission's founding in 1934. In this lecture, we'll explore the reasons why this has grown to be such an issue now, the reasons which are critically tied to the history of net neutrality and the U.S. government policy and litigation back and forth. One useful framework for understanding this is a critical distinction in communications law, dating to the Communications Act of 1934 that, among other things, led to the formulation of the FCC. The 1934 Act includes a number of categories of media for which different policies apply. These categories of media are called titles, and for our discussion about net neutrality, the focus is on the first two of these titles. There's Title I, what's called an information service, and Title II, what's called a telecommunications service. Let's illustrate with some concrete examples. Indeed, we've already seen and you already know these examples. An example of Title I media is cable television, a business pure and simple, where the provider can largely call the shots. The provider has great leverage in deciding what channels are available, for what price, and you as a consumer are basically given the option to accept the terms or leave or go without or find another provider if one exists. And as mentioned in the first lecture, for the vast number of Americans, there is no competitive choice on cable in the cable television market. That's Title I, information service. An example of Title II, telecommunications service, is the telephone, a provider of what's long been touted as universal service. The idea being, you have a telephone and can call anyone else who also has a telephone, with the telephone network allowing you to make your call while providing a strong degree of reliability without degrading your service or increasing or decreasing call quality if you pay more or less. As a result, a great majority of American society has had telephone and telephone access. To be fair, I am drawing broad strokes here. Cable television, which falls under the pro-business Title I classification, does have public service provisions, like the establishment and maintenance of public access television channels. Meanwhile, the U.S. telephone industry has had a long, sordid history of its own: monopoly control, smashing competitors, stifling innovation. But for the purposes of discussing net neutrality, this is the distinction that's particularly useful for the analysis to follow, and it also demonstrates what's at stake with the FCC's vote on net neutrality in 2014. In the previous lecture, we discussed the term net neutrality and the definition proposed by the man who coined the term, law professor Tim Wu. In brief, net neutrality is a network design principle which fosters a maximally useful public information network that aspires to treat all content, sites, and platforms equally. From the earliest days of the Internet in the late 1960s until 2002, that principle of equal treatment was the governing policy for the Internet in the United States. So what changed in 2002? In that year, the Federal Communications Commission carried out a little-known decision that seriously wounded net neutrality. The FCC in 2002, by a 3-to-1 party line vote that got barely any media coverage, the FCC voted to reclassify cable modems from their Title II status of universal service and public access to Title I, controlled by business for business. This would mean that the Internet, which increasingly was being offered as a service by cable companies, was now theoretically on the same legal standing as cable television, with all the blatant money-grubbing and poor quality we've come to expect from most cable TV. The chair of the FCC at the time was Michael Powell, probably best known as the son of former General and Secretary of State Colin Powell. But back in 2002, the same year that the Powell-led FCC made a little-known reclassification decision, Tim Wu wrote an academic paper entitled Network Neutrality, Broadband Discrimination, which coined the term that would gain widespread usage for the policy of non-discrimination on the Internet. The FCC's decision to reclassify cable modems was challenged when a small Internet service provider from California with the less-than-imaginative name Brand X wanted to use cable connections owned by the cable providers to provide Internet service. But they could not because of that 2002 reclassification. Brand X then sued the FCC, and the suit worked its way all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, when the Supreme Court ruled in a mixed 6-3 decision in 2005 that affirmed the FCC's decision to reclassify cable modems as a business rather than as a public service. That decision affirmed the FCC's right. Indeed, in The FCC in 2005 would go on to also reclassify telephone modems in addition to cable modems from Title II to Title I, also along party line votes. But those decisions, as encouraging as the Internet Service Cartel found them, did not lock those decisions into a permanent state. They could be reclassified back. And the fight was now on in Congress. In 2006, the main effort from the corporate ISPs came in the form of the Communications Opportunity Promotion and Enhancement Bill of 2006, abbreviated the COPE Act. The COPE Act had only lukewarm protections for network neutrality, and net neutrality advocates regarded the bill as a step backward for free speech and opportunity with the Internet. The legislative fight over the COPE Act in 2006 marked the first full-throated fight over net neutrality. The COPE Act passed the U.S. House, with Illinois' own 1st District Representative Bobby Rush serving as co-sponsor. Indeed, he was the first sponsor from the Democratic Party on the bill, in fact. But it was in the Senate when the efforts for the COPE Act derailed. Comparable legislation actually passed out of committee in the Senate, with a Republican Senate at the time, the COPE Act's Senate equivalent probably would have passed. But shortly after the Senate committee hearing on the bill ended, the bill's main shepherd, the late Alaska Senator Ted Stevens, opened his mouth. Stevens was recorded decrying net neutrality advocates, but the effect was instead to demonstrate his own profound ignorance of how the Internet actually functions, famously describing the Internet as a series of tubes. That expression wound up gaining widespread popularity and became an embarrassment to the bill. It was never brought to a vote in the Senate, and the COPE Act, as a result, died from inaction, thus helping the net neutrality cause. But the struggle continued, with the FCC as the main forum of action. Michael Powell had left the FCC in 2005 to join the very industry he supposedly regulated. By the way, he currently stands as president of the biggest cable TV lobby in the United States. Powell's successor as FCC chair was Kevin Martin, another one of the commissioners to vote for Title I pro-business reclassification of cable modems. Kevin Martin approved action to support net neutrality, though given that the actions fell under a pro-business framework, that made it vulnerable to subsequent court challenges by the big internet service providers. Nevertheless, a challenge to net neutrality was brought to the commission's attention. Indeed, it's one we saw in our first lecture, the throttling of BitTorrent traffic by Comcast. The FCC fielded the complaint and ruled against Comcast. Comcast instead opted to sue the FCC in response in the hopes of defeating the commission's net neutrality regulations. Mission accomplished. In 2010, in the case Comcast versus FCC, the FCC's net neutrality regulations were struck down. By now, Kevin Martin himself also left the FCC to take his chances on the job market. He is now a consultant with Patton Boggs, a high-powered D.C. lobbying firm. The Republicans, who had carved anti-net neutrality policies for most of the decade between 2000 and 2008, were now out of majority at the FCC. Barack Obama, who on the campaign trail had claimed himself an enormous supporter of net neutrality, was now president. Indeed, as president-elect, he said, quote, "I will take a backseat to no one in my commitment to network neutrality," unquote. So with him being in the White House, there would now be a Democratic Party majority at the FCC. Obama's appointee as FCC chair was Julius Genachowski, an investor, internet business entrepreneur, and media attorney. Genachowski echoed Obama's concern with net neutrality and had a Democratic Party majority to work with. But he was nonetheless swayed by the corporate involvement in media policy. In the summer of 2010, Google and Verizon had struck a net neutrality policy deal, which would grant net neutrality for landline communications, but do without it for wireless communications. That matters greatly for the future of the Internet, because the future of the Internet is increasingly moving to wireless and moving to mobile and away from landline and the web. The other Democratic commissioners at the FCC joined Genachowski in approving the policy. They felt that, imperfect as it was, some net neutrality policy is better than none, and that at least with a policy in place, steps could be taken over time to improve it. So, in December 2010, the FCC along party lines voted into effect a net neutrality policy. All this time, the internet remained in Title I business pro-business classification, leaving it vulnerable to attack in the courts. With no reconsideration of a reclassification back mentioned. Sure enough, a lawsuit against the FCC was filed shortly after they took action. This time, Verizon, who had been a party to crafting the policy that the FCC approved, was now suing the FCC to undo their own lukewarm version of net neutrality. And in January 2014, the FCC lost in court, their extant net neutrality policy struck down. The First Circuit Court in Washington, D.C., which heard the case Verizon versus FCC, did affirm the FCC's right to regulate in the interests of net neutrality, but not to do so as a Title I pro-business information service. By then, Julius Genachowski himself also left the FCC for greener pastures. He is now a part of the notorious high-powered investment firm, the Carlyle Group. And in 2013, President Obama appointed as FCC Chair Tom Wheeler, a former telecom and cable lobbyist. In the wake of the FCC's court loss to Verizon, Wheeler wound up crafting a policy that was the worst of all worlds, essentially recycling the failed policy that had been agreed to by Google and Verizon, and allowing for the establishment of what was so-called paid prioritization among internet service providers, leaving the classification of the internet into the Title I pro-business black hole. Where the FCC is ostensibly serving as a public watchdog, the actual policy is, like much of the FCC's history, that of a corporate lapdog. Meanwhile, during all this time, concentration among commercial internet service providers had decreased. Small-scale ISPs were dying like flies in the wintertime, reducing by 50% during the years from 2000 to 2010. And more than 90% of the wireless internet market is held by just four companies, with more than 60% held by just two companies, Verizon and AT&T. There are, to be sure, various initiatives to try to bring some alternative against the bondage of the incumbent internet service cartel, things like gigabit internet initiatives, community internet efforts, including those underway presently in Chicago, and even large corporate non-ISP efforts along the lines of Google Fiber. Whether or not those efforts succeed remains to be seen. But one thing is certain. If the legal standing of the internet gets changed, you can bet that the actual practice of the internet, or what most people think of as the internet, will also change. The big ISPs even admitted as such. For example, Ed Whitaker, the former CEO of AT&T, in an interview with Business Week magazine in 2005, said that users and producers on the internet, quote, would like to use my pipes for free, but I ain't going to let them do that, unquote. To be sure, the picture I painted in this lecture has not been encouraging, with public policy facing loss after loss, big corporations having a disproportionate influence on policy, and those who craft the policy jumping ship to join the very industry at play. But the policy I've told here represents just one portion of the history of internet policy over the past decade and change. There is another story to tell, one which has been very encouraging and which represents our best hope for the future. There has been in the past decade a resurgence of media activism and public involvement in media policy, the likes of which America has not seen in a generation. It has a number of achievements to its credit, and among those achievements is a dramatic win amid the crafting of the FCC's net neutrality provisions in 2014. The popular outrage fueling it that won the classification of the internet from Title II pro-public telecommunications service to a Title I pro-corporate information service. The overwhelming public outcry over the FCC's policy proposal in barely a month's time forced onto the table the reclassification of the internet back from pro-corporate to pro-public, that in the way that net neutrality so desperately needs. The response forced a massive freakout from the corporate ISPs, who have taken to arms the policy fight to come in 2014. Of course, the popular efforts that won that battle are not perfect. They have their flaws and their weaknesses, but they also have tremendous strengths and the potential to grow and mature.
That concludes this episode of From the Trenches. If you'd like to learn more and get involved, including helping to make this radio program, please visit the website of the Chicago Independent Media Center at chicago.indymedia.org. I'm Bree Hayden. Special thanks to Chicago's Multiculti for audio assistance. And thank you for listening. Be sure to join us again for another episode from the Trenches.